in that piece in the discussion about workplace violence, about what the motivation is of these guys. And if you see some of these risk factors, and they're not profiles with a P, we don't profile people. But if you see some of these risk factors in the people that you work with, you have to have the courage with a capital C to talk to your boss, talk to your HR representative, or talk to your security representative if you have one about your concerns. Why? Because we know in these events, when these things have happened, lots of employees come forward and say, you know, he said to me this, this, and this, and I didn't know who to talk to. I was concerned or afraid, and I didn't know who to talk to. Or he said he was going to do this, this, and this, and I blew it off. I didn't think he was serious about it. And now we feel bad as a person who heard those threats and didn't report them, and somebody was injured or killed as a result, that we didn't do the right thing in terms of being courageous about acting on that type of leakage that we hear. And oftentimes these people leak out what they're going to do. So pretty good discussion in the book about active shooters and workplace violence. Bomb threats. So the issue about bomb threats is they're almost universally in the United States, bomb threats are a hoax. Now, I get a lot of grief about this. If you Google Steve Albrecht and bomb threats, I will pop up in a lot of articles around the country as saying that most bomb threats, the vast majority, 99.9% of them, are hoaxes. Real bombers make bombs. Bomb threat makers make bomb threats. They don't make bombs. Why? Because they want to disrupt the business. They want to scare people. They want to frighten people. They want to shut down the operations. They want to cause evacuations. And they want to watch from a distance while the police and the bomb squad and the sheriffs and everybody shows up and it's a big mess. Real bombers want to kill people. So we look at the Oklahoma City bombing. We look at the World Trade Center, first World Trade Center bombing, I think in 93. We look at the Unabomber. Ted Kaczynski did not make bomb threats. We look at the Marathon bombing. The two Chechen brothers that used the pressure cookers to blow up the Boston Marathon route, those guys do not make bomb threats. They just make bombs. So there's a big disconnect, especially with the media, who doesn't understand this stuff very well, about bombers and bomb threats. So if your organization gets a bomb threat, it is a significant concern. It's illegal, and it frightens people, and we need to call the cops. But in my opinion, we don't necessarily need to evacuate unless we find a suspicious package or we have some knowledge besides just the bomb threat that the person made over the phone or over the internet or over a piece of paper they put on a rock and threw through our window. Now, let's fast forward to the guy in Nashville, this perpetrator in Nashville, who I don't know all the details. I just read some of my colleagues' writings about it, some of my criminal profiler colleagues have written about this guy a little bit. But here's a guy who made a bomb threat and activated the bomb. And so let's look at some of the dynamics here. If he really wanted to kill as many people as possible in the city of Nashville, and thank God he did not, he would have put that motorhome that had the bomb in it in a shopping mall parking lot at Christmas time, on Christmas Eve. Or he would have put it in some place where there was a lot of foot traffic or pedestrian traffic or car traffic coming by that location. He put it downtown, pretty sparsely populated during Christmas Day. Obviously, everybody's home. He put it in front of the AT&T building or near the AT&T building because he had some sort of revenge motivation against those people that he considered the 5G network that they were creating was causing cancer, which he apparently allegedly had. And so here's a guy who, at least the story we know from the media, is that he broadcasts some sort of recording that says a bomb is going to be detonated in 10 or 15 minutes, evacuate the area. That's not what real bombers do, right? And so if he really wanted to kill people, he would not have made the announcement about his bomb. He just would have ignited the bomb. So the idea that he was inside the motorhome, then he detonated the bomb somehow inside, either remotely or with a plunger of some type, and blew up the motorhome and killed himself, that's how he wanted to go out in this sort of blaze of glory. So everybody always asks the motivation question, why would he do that? Well, one, for attention. I mean, even posthumously, even in his grave, this guy's getting a lot of attention because now we're looking at, you know, his computers and what websites he went to, and the FBI and the ATF have already scoured his house, and we know everything about this guy, you know, under the sun in a really short period of time, because maybe that's what he wanted. And so think about the Aurora movie theater shooter in Colorado. When the police went to that guy's house after they got him in custody, he had booby-trapped the house with explosive devices. And you think about the shooter for the Pennsylvania school shooter. He did not allow the cops to get access to his computers. He smashed up all his hard drives and everything before he killed himself at the elementary school where he killed all the kids. So sometimes these perpetrators take their motivation to the grave with them, and sometimes they leave it out there for the FBI and everybody else to figure out what they're all about. So for this guy, he made a bomb threat and he detonated a device. Very rare. It's usually one or the other. So this guy also set up the bomb situation, so it was not as likely to kill the people that, you know, he would have killed differently if he had put it in a shopping mall or he had put it in a parking garage at Christmas time. So we'll still be going into this guy's backstory and what he's all about as the months go on. But that's a perfect example of a guy who deviates from the norm, which is to make a bomb and also have a bomb threat. That's very rare in this country. Other countries, Saudi Arabia, Africa, other places where people use bombs all the time, Latin America, countries like that where bombings are possible, Pakistan, things like that, Middle East, much different. But in the United States, that's how we do stuff. So it's important to look at threats, and that's what we talk about in the book. It's important to look at threats and say, what is the nature of this threat? Is it a bomb threat? Is it a workplace violence threat? Is it some sort of threat that says, you know, I poisoned your products, or I'm going to, you know, harm your delivery system of water or electricity or whatever happens to be? And then, did the threat come in by telephone? What can we hear? Do we record our telephone calls for the police? Did it come in by email? What can we show to our IT experts so they can help us track down what this person's all about? Third thing we talk about in the book is car accidents. And these things can happen in the parking lot of your facility and be quite devastating. Somebody can be hit walking to the building. Somebody can be hit walking between two buildings. I've seen personally these cases happen where delivery vans or delivery drivers have injured or killed employees that are walking from place to place through the parking lot. So those are, you know, significant tragedies. And we talk about paying attention to car accidents and personal injury events that happen at work. Imagine somebody has a heart attack that you work with. Imagine somebody's working in some kind of a shop floor. One of my good friends here works for Tracker Boats, and he talks about all the stuff that happens at work, you know, the machinery and equipment and sharp objects and welding and stuff that's, you know, burning and chemicals and gases that are in that facility, that factory, all the time. That's a manufacturing office. That's, you know, a manufacturing building. That's what they need. So think of all the ways that people could be injured or killed at work through an accident or a heart attack or some kind of a significant first aid event. So, you know, how do we know how to dial 9911 or 911? How do we know how to get access to the first aid kits? How do we know how to get access to the exits and doorways to lead the paramedics right into where this person can be? So we talk about that in the book as well. We talk about car thefts and car break-ins. Think about the possibility, if you're a good car burglar, you know, based on sort of intuition, that you can go to a parking garage or a parking lot, especially for a large organization, and you have access to cars that are going to be parked there for 8 to 10 hours or at least 4 hours until the lunch break, right? So between, you know, 8 and 11, you've got a window of opportunity to steal, and from 2 to 5, you've got a window of opportunity to steal. So you can break into cars, you can steal things out of people's cars, and just imagine all the stuff. We've talked about this on this show, that people leave in their cars, guns, cash, pills, clothing, laptops, expensive stuff that they leave in their car that they don't think about. This person smashes the window and changes your whole day. Think about car thefts. You know, you come out, your car's gone because it's one of those ones that is perfect to steal and ship overseas, or it's one of those cars that loves to be parted out like a Camry or a Honda Civic or a Ford F-150. So we talk about protecting your car and how you can do the best you can in keeping your car from being broken into or stolen from your company parking lot. We talk about dealing with disturbances with people that come into our facilities. If you have a public counter, if you serve the public in a retail environment, if you serve the public in a service environment, if you serve the taxpayer, you serve people that are high risk in their behavior. It could be you serve mentally ill population, you serve a homeless population, you serve people that are angry about what you do as a business service. Think about government and all the things that government does which makes people upset when they come in, tax collectors, stuff like that. So we talk about dealing with disturbances and threatening people face-to-face, over-the-counter, in the environment that you're in. We talk about dealing with people who use drugs and alcohol to solve their life problems. So you may have a population that you deal with who is drug and alcohol addicted, and you may deal with them as, you know, in a retail environment, or in a restaurant environment, in a service environment where people come in, they're under the influence people who use drugs have problems with their behavior being cyclical. They're up, they're down, they're angry, they're passive, they're cooperative, they're highly uncooperative, and so that changes in a matter of seconds. And so you have to think about what their sort of overall emotional stability is as you deal with them, especially over the counter or even in the parking lot where they come into your business, whether you want them there or you're providing services to them. We talk about domestic violence in the book as well, Stay Safe at Work. And domestic violence crosses over from home to work. And I've done a show, a podcast episode on this exact issue. Think about people who have an off-the-job concern with their spouse or partner, same-sex, sexual orientation, male, female, young and old, where the perpetrator is broken up with the victim and the victim maybe moves out of her home. I know that men are domestic violence victims as well, but I use her just for simplicity's sake, and the statistics bear this out, that she leaves the apartment or house, condo that they were living in. She changes her cell phone number. She changes her hair color, paints her car a different color. Where is she 8 to 10 hours a day? She's still at work. And that's where these perpetrators come in. And we've seen a number of tragic cases around this country. I remember a shooting where a doctor was killed by her ex-boyfriend in a hospital in Chicago while she was on duty. Where these perpetrators come in, they say, you know, I can't get at you to attack you because I don't know where you are outside of this environment, but I know you're here at work 8 to 10 hours a day because you're not going to abandon your job. You may change all the other things in your life, but you're not going to quit your job. Part of our chapter discussion is how we talk to employers about protecting their employees from domestic violence. Better physical security, better access control, better awareness of the situation, and even moving the employee to a new facility, a new department, a new building, getting private security as necessary, or a liaison with the police to help solve the issue with the attacker. So one of the issues of domestic violence in the workplace is that people are embarrassed and fearful that they're going to get fired. They're embarrassed and fearful that someone's going to find out about their personal life. And as employers, we have to say, look, this is not a great situation. It's here. We need to help you manage it. And as an employer, you can't say it's not my problem, because when the guy shows up with a gun in your lobby and you knew about the fact that he may have done that, it can become your problem, especially from a tragedy standpoint and a litigation standpoint as well. What did you know and when did you know it? So we talk about domestic violence as a workplace issue that crosses over from home to work. I talk about facility security in the book. Just where are we thinking in terms of how we use access control? And I'm a big believer in key cards. I love key cards. They're better than hard keys. An employee can lose a set of hard keys for your building, and because he or she is embarrassed and doesn't want to get in trouble, they won't tell us for 3 weeks. And somebody finds them and makes copies, and then we're in a big mess. Key cards, in contrast, we go and we pull the person from the system, we give them a brand new card, and life goes on. We give them a little lecture about being more careful with their key card, but that takes 2 seconds, and we give them a new key card, and we pulled the old one off and deactivated it, so we're back to being secure again. So we talk about physical security, we talk about facility security, how you can protect your building, lighting, cameras, things like that. We talked a little bit about dealing with high-risk, difficult drug and alcohol, mentally ill people over the counter in certain types of businesses, but we also talk in our book about field visits. Some employees go into the field. They go to people's homes. They provide medical care inside people's homes. They do repairs inside people's homes. They go into the field to do work as a public works environment. They go into the field to do work as a private sector employer to do work on things that are infrastructure related. That's part of your products and services. How do you deal with people safely and securely in a field environment out in the streets? It could be homeless that you come in contact with. It could be drug and alcohol users. It could be mentally ill people. How do we keep our field personnel safe when they're out working in the field? Talk in the book about fire safety. Again, we discussed this in the beginning of our discussion here today about how we sort of take that for granted in our environments, that there's no chance the building's going to catch on fire. I don't need to really think about it. But think about those types of buildings where we have a factory connected to an office environment. We have a manufacturing plant connected to an office environment. It's much more likely that those things might happen. So what is our fire posture? How do we
paramedics are going to come to our business, and they're going to come in and rescue and help people that are having.
Sorry.
So we talked about first aid events and medical emergencies, and that kind of takes us into our discussion about pandemics and flu season and the whole response to pandemics, where we are now thinking about personal distance and hand washing and hygiene and things connected to the pandemics that we never thought of before. Now masks are built into our discussion in the workplace as well. Part of our discussion is also in the book about gangs and gang problems. If your workplace is in a neighborhood where gang activity is possible, you may come across these folks. Matt, if we could go down just a little bit. If you come across these people as part of the parking lot or the parking garage, or they come into your business, this is a problem I help libraries deal with, is gang members coming into libraries and selling drugs or tagging or marking stuff or stealing things. So we talk in the book about the neighborhoods that gang members frequent, and if it's where your business is, you may have that issue where they're hanging around your facility. We talk about the impact of trespassers and homeless people in the book. Now, certainly not all homeless people or trespassers are dangerous. A small number of them are predatory and can steal from us. A lot of them just want whatever we have in our organization that may give them access to bathrooms or food or water or that type of thing. So we talk about interacting with homeless people around our facilities, coming into our facilities, or even in field discussions as well. And trespassers, how we use good physical security and fencing and lighting and access control and perimeter fencing and things that are, you know, exterior cameras and security services to make sure we're not having trespassers come into our facilities or steal from us. Speaking of stealing, one of the discussions in the book is about internal threats and where, you know, oftentimes the big joke in retail establishments oftentimes is we lose, a fair amount of product going out the door, especially during a busy Christmas season, being stolen by shoplifters. But actually, in reality, more retail theft occurs from employees, more things being stolen, or if it's a restaurant, eaten or drunk by employees than by outside people. So I think the shrinkage rate in the United States is like 1% of gross profits of a retail environment, but it's actually higher if we look at the employees who are doing the stealing. Certainly a small number of employees are the ones that do this. Most employees are honest and don't do that. A small number do. We think about internal theft of equipment, devices, office supplies, expensive things, laptops, tablets, computers, things like that get stolen from employees. And what is our discussion in the book about how we protect our assets, things that we have in there that are financial, fiduciary, trade secrets, things like that. We talk about economic espionage. And that sounds like a James Bond kind of a thing where people break in and steal company secrets, sort of a Tom Cruise Mission Impossible thing, but it's very common. You think about trade secrets, you think about product designs, you think about prototypes, you think about software code, you think about customer lists and things that are very valuable to organizations that can be stolen either by an outsider or an insider and sold to somebody else or given to somebody else. When I was in graduate school, I remember one of my professors was a former CIA agent, and he talked about how routinely Air France would put listening devices, bugs, in the airplanes of Air France flights that would have Washington, D.C. executives or Washington, D.C. politicians on there to hear what they were talking about as they flew over to France to go to meetings. Imagine that. I mean, you know, they have a bunch of Boeing executives on an Air France flight going over to Paris to talk about the Paris Air Show, and they're actually listening to what's being said. So a lot of countries around the world have their intelligence agencies provide intelligence data, economic intelligence data, economic espionage data to their companies in their countries. That's illegal for the CIA to do in the United States. We don't do that. We don't say to Boeing, hey, here's what we heard in the bugs that were, you know, at the Airbus meeting here. We don't do that. But other countries, lots of other countries do that, and they provide economic espionage information to their companies and to their government employers all the time. So when you think about economic espionage, from our standpoint, it's really about making sure that the things that we create and manufacture and develop stay inside our company and stay safe that way. We talk about IT security in the book, and IT security from, you know, beyond just making sure that you change your passwords occasionally and that you don't write your password on the bottom of your on a post-it note, put it on the bottom of your keyboard, and that you don't make your password what everybody else's password is, which is 4321 password or something like that. We talk in the book about robbery prevention and how we can be robbed inside our facilities from a retail environment. Pretty thorough discussion about that. And also leaving the facility or coming into the facility, especially if you're going from a parking garage into the building, that type of stuff. We talk about self-defense at work, how you can protect yourself. We talk about whether or not you should bring guns to work, which is a very careful discussion. Also about pepper spray, things like that, and then self-defense in general at work. A pretty brief discussion in our book about terrorism, but a lot of things may be connected to the idea that some of the terrorism could be driven by IT and, you know, these mass attacks that come from outside countries that are attacking our servers for our companies, but also just terrorism awareness about people or situations or events that could concern you enough to call the FBI. We talk about vandalism and tagging and graffiti so that, you know, if you see these things, it may be a warning sign from gang activity around you. It could be just a disgruntled ex-employee. There's lots of things that are sort of connected to vandalism or tagging or graffiti. Then lastly, we talk about weather and disaster preparedness. And so in my part of the world is tornadoes, and in California it was earthquakes and wildfires, and in Florida it's hurricanes. And so when you look at what part of the country you're in, it could be snow or rain emergencies in your part of the world, where your business is a focal point to keep employees safe if they can't get home, or your business is a one of those places where there's considerable concern about how people get into the building from, you know, the parking lot during an ice storm and things like that. So we talk about that in a lot of detail. And then the last part of the book is just a collection and in the appendix of just general safety and security tips, a lot of stuff that I've been talking about in this show all our time that we've been doing it. So the book is called Stay Safe at Work, Your Ultimate Guide to Workplace Security. It's available now on Kindle, and it will be out on paperback next year, next spring. So thanks for listening to me talk about the book. And I want to wrap up with my favorite parts of the show, which is Crime Time's Stupidest Crook of the Week. So one of my favorite parts of the show, Crime Time's Stupidest Crook of the Week, where I get to talk about some of our dumbest criminals who managed to get themselves arrested based on their monumental stupidity. Dateline Fort Pierce, Florida. Authorities say a Florida woman is blaming a windy day for the cocaine that police found in her purse. It blew in there. A radio station in Florida reported that this woman was one of two passengers in a car stopped by Fort Pierce police. In March, police say an officer smelled marijuana. That, and after searching the car, cocaine and marijuana in separate bags were found inside a purse this woman had on her lap. When the police questioned her about the drugs, she said in a report, quote, "It's a windy day. It must have flown through the window and into my purse." She was charged with a felony count of cocaine possession and a misdemeanor count of marijuana possession and released on bail. The old "it flew into my purse" defense. And maybe, I don't know, try that in front of the judge and see what he or she says when you use that as your defense. So that's our stupid crook of the week. Let's test your Crime Time IQ with this week's crime quiz question. What agency of the United States government is responsible for physically moving our most valuable possessions across the country? Is it the FBI? Is it the U.S. Marshals? Do we use private security? The answer is the Postal Service. The Postal Service is responsible for moving most of the valuable paper documents, most of the physical assets, gold, jewelry, firearms across the country for us. So in 1937 and from 1940 to 1941, the Postal Service moved $14 billion in gold bullion from New York and Philadelphia in the mints, there the New York Mint and the Philadelphia Mint, to Fort Knox, Kentucky. using an elaborate system of decoy trains and armed postal inspectors and steel doors and officers armed with machine guns in 1937 and 1940 to 41. They moved $14 billion with a B dollars worth of gold from New York and Philly to Fort Knox, where it is in the Fort Knox vault. The Hope Diamond, the famous Hope Diamond, which is in the Smithsonian. In 1958, on the night before it was delivered to the National Museum of Natural History in the Smithsonian, and a postal inspector protected the famous Hope Diamond, which was secured in a registered mail cage at the Washington, D.C. post office. And then every year, millions of dollars in bonds, which can be converted and into cash, jewelry and money orders move in a special convoy, which is called a con-con box, concentration and convoy container. That's three cons, right? Concentration and convoy containers under armed postal inspector conditions between the shippers and you, the postal service, and the recipients. So the post office is moving stuff all the time, drugs, pharmaceutical stuff, diamonds, guns, ammunition, gold, bearable bonds and all that stuff all the time. That's part of their function since they were created back in 1780, whatever it was, with Ben Franklin. This is our Crime Time safety tip of the week. This week's tip is all about ATM safety. If you can, use the drive-up machine, not the walk-up machine. I still see people at the walk-up machine at nighttime. Even during the day, using the walk-up machine is not the best choice. If you can, use the inside lobby ATM during business hours. There's tellers there. There's people there. There may be even bank security. Now, avoid using the inside lobby ATM box after hours so you don't get trapped inside a steel soundproof box, a glass soundproof box with a robber. So avoid those situations where you're going to be locked inside of a small room, a glass room, with a robber with your ATM card. If anyone approaches your card during the transaction, hit the cancel key and get your card back and drive away. Or hit the cancel key, roll up your windows, and stay put and call police. At the walk-up, if somebody's behind you and you feel uncomfortable, hit the cancel key on your ATM and say as loudly as you can, "I can't believe my," fill in the blanks here, "husband, wife, girlfriend, boyfriend took all my money," and then snatch your card out and stomp away. That's one sort of tactic to keep people from putting a gun to your head and say, "Give me all your money out of your ATM." So when you think about ATM safety, it's about convenience sometimes. Go to the ones that are the safest for you. Stay in your car if you can. So thanks for listening to this episode of Crime Time. I encourage you to go to my website at crimetimeradio.com and send me an email with questions or topics you want me to cover on future shows. Connect with me on LinkedIn and follow me on Twitter at Dr. Steve Albrecht. In our world, there are sheep and shepherds and wolves. Too many people are sheep and too few people are shepherds. There are a lot of wolves out there. There are not enough police officers or sheriff's deputies to protect us all, so you need to be a shepherd. Take care of yourself and protect your family and your loved ones and your friends and coworkers. Pay attention and be prepared to defend yourself with legal force if necessary. Be a good witness for the police. Stay safe and aware and alert. Thanks for listening to Crime Time. Thanks to Jim Whining, producer Matt, producer Jay, and all the good folks at Axe Media Group. Happy New Year. I'm Steve Albrecht, and thanks for listening to What I Know Is Right.